Well, thank you all for coming. The title of the lecture, The 10 Most Beautiful Experiments, is a book that I'm writing, and I just recently finished the 9th chapter, and I thought I'd just use it as a way to first talk a little bit about the book and the process of writing one, a book for, you know, the general public about science, and then maybe go, and then go from there into talking about the 10 experiments that I chose, and I'd like to get your feedback. I mean, you know, at this point, it's not real likely that I'll decide to, I'll tear up chapter 3 and 4 and do something else, but I thought that some of the fun of the book...
You might rename it The 9 Most Beautiful Experiments.
Yeah, I thought about that. Yeah, that'd be the way to go, because that would, you know, get it to... It's actually due at the publisher in middle of January, and it's like 2 years over, 2 years late so far. So talk about that, because I think one of the fun things when the book comes out is going to be reading the reviews, and then everybody gets to, you know, say what experiments I should have included and didn't, and why did I include that one anyway. But this is the list. I'm starting with Galileo's experiment with the inclined plane and the rolling balls, and then my original thought was to do this entirely about physics experiments, but then I decided I'd go a little broader, which made it even harder to narrow it down to 10. I should say that my criteria in choosing these was I didn't want to do great discoveries or accidental serendipitous occasions, like when Becquerel discovered radioactivity. I wanted something where a scientist, usually just one, maybe two, sat down and figured out some way to pose a question to nature and get, a reasonably unambiguous answer. Of course, they never seem nearly so unambiguous when you start looking back at the original papers. But that was really my operating principle. So the second one I picked was William Harvey and his discovery of the circulation of the blood. And there I stretched my definition a little, and I had to kind of decide for myself which of his many hundreds of experiments and vivisections extending over many years that I would call his beautiful experiment. You know, beautiful in the sense of being very, very elegant, both in the setup of the experiment and in the logic of the interpretation. And then, of course, Isaac Newton on the refrangibility of light with the prism. And then, of course, this is all chronological order. And then I went over to Lavoisier, who, you know, the short way to say it is that he discovered oxygen, but of course he really didn't, and that, you know, Priestley did. But Lavoisier, you could argue, I think, did it more definitively and elegantly and knew what he'd found, while Priestley thought he had found, phlogisticated air, you know, with the... or deflogisticated air with the phlogiston removed. Luigi Galvani and animal electricity, which actually turned out not to be animal electricity in the sense that he thought it was, but then kind of opened the way to bimetallic electricity in Volta and in the development of the voltaic cell. Michael Faraday with electromagnetic induction. And I'm going to show you just how I started some of these chapters in a minute. James Joule with work as the mechanical equivalent of heat. And then Michelson, of course, who turns out to be really an interesting character that I had no idea. And then Ivan Pavlov, which I felt I was getting a little top-heavy on physics, so I wanted to switch to Pavlov and his conditioned reflex. And he had some just really very, very elegant experiments. One of the challenges for me in describing Pavlov's experiments and William Harvey's experiments is they're going to make a lot of my readers, I know, very squeamish. And PETA is not going to, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, is not going to like them. So I tried to use this as an excuse to write also and consider the question, can an experiment, you know, be beautiful if it does cause suffering to another creature? And trying to weave in some of these bigger themes. Last, I'm doing Robert Millikan and his famous oil drop experiment, and I haven't figured out a title for that one yet. And
a lot of these will probably change. And why are all the experiments sort of like over 100 years back?
Because I wanted to, as I see it, pretty much once you get into the early 20th century, you find very few cases where you had a, you know, I was going for the single scientist setting up like an apparatus, preferably something you could do on a tabletop. And there were experiments after that, but I kind of just fairly arbitrarily decided to cut it off in the early 20th century, but I might be convinced to do otherwise, and you know.
Do a sequel for the
20th century. Yeah. Or I can make it the 13 most beautiful experiments or something. You know, that's part of what I hope that some of the art is in the arbitrariness. You know, why 10 beautiful experiments? And one of my colleagues at the Times just said, you can't call it the 10 most beautiful experiments. I mean, who are you? You know, just call it 10 beautiful experiments. And I say, no, that just doesn't have the right ring. So instead, I wrote a preface kind of describing my criteria and sort of acknowledging, you know, that there's a certain artificial form to this. But, you know, I hope it serves, you know, the purpose of bringing some of the these great experiments to the readers that might not ordinarily read this kind of thing. And just to give you an idea of how I'm approaching this, I'm just going to show you the beginnings of a couple of the chapters. This is the one on James Prescott Joule, and I'll try, you know, start most of them with a quotation, usually from the author, or someone that just kind of sets the tone. And I really like this quote. To me, it brought back this whole feeling of a time when people just really didn't know what energy was, and people talked about the vis viva, or the living force, and trying to capture the sense of what it was like as a scientist, not knowing what we know now, and just looking out at this world that isn't labeled the way it's labeled now, and trying to figure out what's going on. When I started with, I found this really, really neat story involving Joule and William Thomson, or Lord Kelvin. Pull that up here. Let's see, how can I do this? Not a whole lot has been written about Joule compared to Kelvin, but there's this classic two-volume biography of Kelvin, and I ran across this story that I tried to recapture. We don't know what William Thomson was thinking as he set out on foot on a cloudy August day in 1847 from Chamonix toward Saint-Gervais, but it probably had something to do with physics. A child prodigy, he had published his first scientific paper when he was 16. Fresh out of Cambridge at 22, he was named to the chair of natural philosophy at the University of Glasgow, and now, a year later, was trekking in the French Alps, bound for Mont Blanc. All the forces of nature, Thomson was coming to believe, must be related. He had been inoculated with Faraday fire. This comes after a chapter on Faraday. And he may have been turning that thought over in his head as he approached the turnoff for the high trail over the Col du Buhomme, I can't pronounce French, and encountered the familiar face of another hiker, James Prescott Joule. Joule was on his honeymoon. His wife was following behind in a carriage, and he was carrying, or so Thomson would later recount, a long thermometer with which to measure the temperature of waterfalls. If Joule was right, the water at the bottom of the fall must be slightly warmer than the water at the top, and that would mean the prevailing theory of heat, the one force of nature Thomson found most puzzling, was incorrect. He agreed to meet up with Joule a few days later at the Cascade de Solange, probably the 1,190-foot Arpenaz waterfall, which by Joule's reckoning should show a temperature difference of roughly 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit. There was too much spray to take an accurate reading, Thomson reported. Daedalus, the two men went their separate ways. The story's probably a little too neat. And then I go back and kind of backtrack and describe how a lot of historians of science really doubt that they really measured the waterfall, because Joule never mentions it in any of his papers. And this reminiscence was written by Kelvin later in life when he was kind of famous for, you know, doing some fairly revisionist recollections, as as I'm sure we all do. And Kelvin's letters to his father from that time, they mention him meeting Jewell on the road and in the thermometer, but I think that's in the letter. But they don't actually mention doing the experiment. But, you know, it's just a way to get into the story and then just kind of step back. And, you know, the context is really interesting. He grew up in Manchester, and his family ran a brewery there. And this was the time when the steam engine was really, you know, like a supercomputer or would be today, or a nuclear reactor, you know, the middle of last century. It was just this incredible technology. And, you know, Jewell remembered watching, you know, the first time a steam engine pulling a train came into Manchester, and just what an incredible thing it was, because, you know, he'd, you know, been born into the horse and buggy age, and then suddenly the steam engine. And then the steam engine was just very mysterious to people. There were all these competing theories of how a steam engine worked, because they didn't understand what energy was. And people thought of heat as, like, you know, falling down a gradient, and they compared it to a waterfall, you know, falling down a cliff and turning a paddle wheel, and just all these, you know, like, implicit in all these were the seeds of things like the conservation of energy, which Kelvin later kind of put the stamp on. And it was all up in the air. So, you know, I try to, you know, just describe the context and how the steam engine at that point was transforming England, so you could actually have industry somewhere other than on rivers. You know, you could have mills out in the countryside. And and then this whole, you know, in, you know, caloric, people thought heat was made of the substance called caloric. And of course that turned out not to be the case. And yeah, a little more on that. And then, you know, all this is by way of getting into, you know, describing the actual experiments. And I'm sure a lot of you know his experiment where he had a canister with a paddle wheel in it, and he figured, you know, if you turn the paddle wheel, it'll heat the water a certain amount, and if he could measure how much work he was doing to turn the paddle and then measure how much heat he produced, he would have a, you know, this idea of a connection between work and heat. And along the way, make the case that heat was a vibration and not some sort of subtle fluid, as they called it, named caloric. And the way he did this was, you know, he set up his paddle wheel thing, and then it had a pulley on it and a system of pulleys, and he had two weights, so he could, like, you know, suspend, I can't remember the numbers, but he would suspend, say, a 100-pound weight 5 feet above the ground and then let it slowly drop and turn the paddle and mark that. And he would do it enough times that he could measure a slight little temperature difference. And some people since then have looked back and just doubt that calorimetry could have possibly been precise enough for him to really do it. So there's a certain controversy there. And in the end, you know, this idea that heat could be a vibration had started with another scientist who was boring cannons for the German military, and of course he noticed that they would get hot when they were boring out this metal, and that, you know, led him to think, well, you know, I don't think, like, caloric is, you know, if caloric is flowing out of the metal because we're releasing it by abrading it, it seems like there must be an infinite amount of caloric in the cannon because it just keeps getting hot. And he proposed that, no, it must be a vibration, and other people had said the same thing. And it turned out, I was surprised to find a really neat connection with one of my previous chapters on Lavoisier, who you may know went to the guillotine after the French Revolution, because in addition to discovering oxygen, he was also a tax collector for the government and part of the ancient regime. So his widow, Anne Marie, ends up getting involved with this Count Rumford, the guy who did the cannon experiment, who was really, really, I mean, it seems pretty clear he was marrying her for his money. He'd done this before in the United States, and then he had to leave because he ended up on the wrong side of the American Revolution, supporting the British, and then he invented all these things like the Rumford stove and things, and does his famous cannon experiment and meets Lavoisier's widow at one of her grand salons in Paris, and convinces her to marry him, and it's a short story. After a four-year courtship, he persuaded Anne-Marie to be his wife and moved into her mansion. The marriage didn't last. One day, jealous of his solitude, he locked her guests out of the house. She retaliated by pouring boiling water, rich in caloric, on his roses. Finally, she paid him 300 to 400,000 francs to go away. So yeah, I'd like to weave a little bit of things like that into the science. And so in each chapter is structured pretty much like that. It starts with a story. I'll just briefly show you some of the other starting stories, and then we can move on. Let me do rather than Newton, I'll do Lavoisier. Because it just really fascinated me that this starts out outside the Louvre, and I keep picking these ones with French. Outside the Louvre in the Jardin de l'Infant on an autumn day in 1772, Parisians strolling along the Seine might have noticed a strange contraption, a wooden platform on six wheels like a flatbed wagon, on top of which was mounted an assembly of enormous pieces of glass. The two largest lenses, 8 feet in radius, had been sandwiched together into a single powerful magnifier that captured the solar rays, beaming them through a second smaller lens and onto a table around which scientists in powdered wigs and dark glasses were performing an experiment. On the deck, assistants, like midshipmen, cranked pulleys and adjusted the rigging on the deck. The rigging as they followed the sun across the sky. One of the men who had booked time on the machine, an historian has called it the particle accelerator of its day, was Antoine Laurent de Lavoisier, who was trying to find out what happens when you incinerate diamonds. And that's the machine. What fascinated me was, and this leads into the story about Lavoisier, this patrician scientist in Paris, and who figures out again this mystery of why things burn. What is oxidation? And everyone thought it had something to do with phlogiston, another one of these subtle fluids that turned out not to exist except in the theories. And what really fascinated me about this contraption here is that it resembles in many ways the guillotine that was later used to. Just skip to the bottom. In 1794, during the Reign of Terror, he and Anne-Marie's father were convicted, along with other tax farmers, that's what they called the tax people, tax farmers, as enemies of the state, and brought by wagon to the Place de Révolution, where a wooden platform had been erected, every bit as imposing as the one where he had tried to burn diamonds. In place of the giant lenses was another example of French technology, the guillotine. A story ricocheting through the internet a while ago insisted that before his execution, Lavoisier arranged to perform one final experiment. The guillotine had been promoted in France as a particularly humane form of execution, manufacturing an instantaneous, painless death. There was only one way to find out. The moment he felt the executioner's blade touch his neck, Lavoisier would begin blinking his eyes as many times as he could. An assistant standing among the crowd would count the blinks. It's too bad the story's probably not true. It sounds like just the kind of thing Lavoisier might have done. So, now, why don't we open up the discussion about, either about what experiments I chose, what you think I should choose, and just generally about writing books. And we are fortunate to have in the office two of my fellow journalists and book writers, including Tom Siegfried, who many of you know was the science writer in residence before I was, and Jerry Roberts, who those of you who live in Santa Barbara will know was the editor of the Santa Barbara News Press before the big blow up there that you'll read about all over the place, including in the national press, but not in the Santa Barbara News Press itself. So please chime in. Yes?
This isn't what you were asking.
No, that's okay.
I'm wondering, you have a bunch of stories that are probably not true. As you know, I'm writing a book and I'm filling it with things that are probably not true because it's easy to find these untrue things on the internet that work so perfectly.
They're all over the place.
What are your sources for these, and what is your criteria for how
Well, I only...
How doubtful can it be?
Well, I only use them if I cast doubt on it. I mean, like the story about Kelvin and Joule taking the temperature of the waterfall, it has obviously seeds of truth because they did meet on the trail, and then it later led to sort of a collaboration between the two scientists and the real boosting of Joule's career because he was very obscure. And it's something that you'll read in all the standard biographies with... I think the original two-volume biography, which is just called Lord Kelvin, presents it as you know just at face value, and then later biographies kind of say, well, you know. But I think as long as you something like that, it's so famous, it's been used in the history of science, and if you do use it yourself, which is hard to resist, you want to make sure you put it in context and say we don't know. And then that begs the question of why use it at all if you don't know if it's true. But if it serves a purpose in your story as far as to advance it and draw readers in, that seems okay to me. The Lavoisier blinking one, I'm a little less sure about. That seems a little sleazy. But
there's considerable literature on that, I mean, on the attempts to see how long your last stuff here has been chopped off.
Really?
Yeah,
oh. Oh, I didn't know that.
Unfortunately, I can't remember where I'm going to ask you about it.
They're probably not on archive, right?
They got them on the internet.
Oh,
it was in one of those.
Oh, really?
Book things with
oh, that's good. I didn't know that. Well, maybe I can find out enough to maybe flesh that. I'll get back to you on that. That's good to know.
How many
blinks are there? Yeah. I think it wasn't. Well, there was an account of one incident, which I don't think was Lavoisier, where there was a claim that there was a perceptible interval where the person was still...
Maybe that... I hadn't been able to figure out where the... Well, let's see, it was mentioned on a PBS TV show, some documentary, and that's when it got into the internet, but it must have come from somewhere before that. But, yeah, something to look into. Yes?
As a thought for a scientist that you might want to include a set of experiments that he did, there's a great biography of Rutherford.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if David Wilson wrote it. It's a real long book, but it tells you about all the experiments. And until I read that book, I didn't realize how much of nuclear physics, particle physics, whatever you call this today, came from Rutherford's tabletop experiments. And they were all tabletop experiments.
Yeah.
Splitting the atom.
Yeah.
With alpha, beta, gamma rays to finding out what helium was, alpha rays with helium, and then splitting the atom. All these things could be going.
Yeah. No, that's a good... And I had really considered doing the gold foil experiment. And another one of my arbitrary... kind of rules I set for myself was to try to not do too, if I wanted to do just probably one early 20th century, what would now be called a particle physics experiment. So I thought I could do Michelson or I could do Rutherford. But, I'm actually going to have an epilogue, too, where I express, all the ones I wish I should have included.
And, he got this Nobel Prize in chemistry for transmutation of the elements.
Yeah.
What people thought were fundamental elements which can never change. Mm-hmm. So indivisible could change.
Yeah.
Actually changing, right?
Yeah.
There's a huge argument, discussion between him and a chemist, I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
Where they hatched it out and then started collaborating on these problems. So it's a great...
Sounds great. Yeah, in any case, I'd love to read the biography. Sarah?
Sort of following on that, how much of the stories that you've chosen here focus on competition pushing ideas forward versus inspiration of the individual?
It kind of depends on the story, because someone like Newton or Galileo, even more so, the last thing anyone needs is another description, of Newton, at the Inquisition and. And just all the usual, Galileo, and just all the usual Galileo stories, and there's just so many of them. So I tried to just kind of go over those really quickly and just sort of invoke them, with brush strokes, just reminding people of what they're, already going to know, and then concentrating more on the actual experiment. So, for example, on there. Again, there's this controversy later of people saying there's no way that Galileo could have done this experiment, where he had the inclined plane and then he rolled the balls down them and then he timed them at different points and came up with the time squared law of acceleration, and he describes that in his dialogues. In his dialogues on the two new sciences is just a wonderful book. And you know, his other book, the more famous one, Dialogue on the Two Great World Systems, I think is like the best piece of science writing and ever written. It's just wonderfully accessible, and you really see someone thinking. But I was trying to look for a different angle, and then I found this controversy, of course, and people saying there's no way he could have done this experiment, and he says he timed it with a water clock, where he just had water dripping into a flask, and then he would weigh it, and this is how he would quantify the time that the ball had taken to roll. And then people say there's just no way you can get that. Or sometimes in his dialogues he'd say he did it with his pulse. And people have reenacted the experiments, and they've shown you can indeed demonstrate the experiment with the water clock if you already know the T-squared law. And you can use it as a demonstration, but people really doubted that he could have actually come up with it that way. And then there was this historian of science, Stillman Drake, who was looking through the Galileo archives in Florence and found a notebook that for some reason had been overlooked, and or else he just looked at it more closely, and he found Newton's lab manual for the experiment with all of his notes and values crossed out. Galileo's lab manual, and you could tell that it was real data. I mean, it was it was just close enough to get the T-squared law. There were places where he crossed out, and maybe he was, it looked very much like real data. And then Drake went on to think, well, how could he have done the experiment? And he decided that one possible way that you can measure time with that precision is with music. And that any reasonably musically literate person can tell, can sense a 64th note and tell the difference from, say, a 32nd note. And he proposed that Newton, who was a musician and a lute player, might have done the experiment like this. He would take the inclined plane and he would put catgut frets on it, like they had on lutes then, and you'd move them up and down to tune it. He would roll the ball and then he would adjust these frets until he could hear that he sounded like he was taking an equal amount of time between each click as it hit the catgut across the inclined plane. And then he would hum to himself some song, and Stillman Drake did the experiment himself, and he used Onward Christian Soldiers, which is a little anachronistic, but just like Onward Christian Soldiers, and then you could get the beat, and then you would just slowly keep fine tuning until you got the frets arranged so you got equal clicks, and you would measure it by your song, and then you would go and measure them, and then you would have the data for the T-squared law. And Drake makes a really persuasive case that that could have been how he got this. So
how does he make the case? I mean, you said he's it sounds like a nice idea.
Yeah. Well, he makes
evidence that that's the way he did it.
Yeah. No. Well, when I say made the case that he found some way to measure and get real data, and then Drake. I should have said that Drake makes a strong case that that's a way that he could have done it with the technology that was existing then. Yeah. No, but it's a fun thing to think about. Yeah.
There's this routine in Florence.
Yeah.
Where apparatus.
Right.
Dance.
Right.
And bells.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All with ringing these bells.
Right, right.
And you would adjust the position of the trip.
Yeah. And the way those... I know. But all of those were really dismissed by a lot of historians before Drake as being demonstrations and things that wouldn't have been precise enough to... I'm not saying they're right, but that's what the controversy was. But... That's interesting. But this is getting a little specific. Is anyone have any questions just in general about book writing? I mean, one day if your paper or experiment gets written up in the New York Times, you might get a call from John Brockman. Some of you know who he is, this agent, and he'll say, "Hey, I can get you $1 million for a book." And some of you have probably gotten that call already, but it's an interesting business, and I'd be happy to talk about it, or I'm sure Tom or Jerry would chime in if it's of interest. And
When agents call like that, what audience are they
anticipating? Oh, general audience. For that, I mean, $1 million is, I wish. But this guy Brockman is an interesting phenomenon. He started out as, if I remember the history right, he used to hang out with Andy Warhol, back in those days in the East Village in New York, and then later promoted things in the 60s and 70s called happenings. And his big break into being a literary agent was that he represented the Whole Earth Catalog when it was sold to Random House for some large amount of money, and gets 10 to 15%. And later he represented this book called The Tao of Physics by Fritz Dov Capra, which apparently still sells thousands of copies a month. So I think it's fair to say that most of the popularized science books that are written by scientists, the agent is John Brockman, including Brian Greene's book, The Elegant Universe, and John gets 15% every time the cash register rings. So he has this big estate up in Connecticut and can do a lot better being an agent than being an author, I think.
What's his address?
That I don't know. Yes?
Yeah, I was just curious how you came to the idea to write this book in particular, and maybe some of the other books. I know you've had several, like, every couple of years, last decade or two.
Yeah, really, I basically make my living writing the books, and then I supplement that with writing for the Times and occasionally other magazines. In this case, this is the only book, I think, where I was asked to do it and didn't propose it myself. I had written an article for the New York Times about a survey that had appeared, it must have been four years ago or something like that, in Physics World. And this historian of science at Stony Brook, Robert Kreese, who's a friend of mine, who was a co-author of a wonderful book called The Second Creation, this history of 20th century particle physics. It's just beautifully written. But Bob had done this survey of asking the readers of Physics World what they thought the 10 most beautiful experiments in physics were, and then they responded, and then he wrote an article about this, and I was just kind of looking for something to write about that week, and I hadn't been in the paper for a while, and I was looking at Physics World, and I thought, well, I could write an essay about Bob's experiment and describe how he did this survey, and then what his results were. And in Physics World, he just listed the experiments, and then I was able to write a little, a couple paragraphs annotating each one, and then I think there was a quote from Bob in there. Just a nice short piece, and I didn't spend a whole lot of time on it. And then the next week, I heard from three publishers who said, "Oh, we think this would really make a good book." And I finally ended up doing it with one of them was my editor that I was already writing a book for at Knopf. And so I said, "Well, yeah, okay." So and that's the point, where your agent gets into the process and negotiates you some advance that sounds really good at the time because you think you're going to write it in 1 year, and then this was 2002. So and then after, one reason it's taken so long is after this all happened, I found out from Bob that he had been shopping around a book on this very subject before my article came out, and he hadn't had any takers on the publishers that he tried. And then once the article came out in the Times, he was able to sell his book. So I thought, well, it's not really a problem because I'm not doing the same experiments he is. There's obviously some overlap, I have a really kind of a different concept. But and then I mentioned Bob's in the beginning as being kind of his piece being the inspiration for this and his book. So I talked to my publisher, and they decided we should kind of hold back for a while and let that book come out. And there's no reason to rush. It's not. It's nice writing about science because usually it's not timely, so you're not under a lot of, at least something like this, you're not under a lot of pressure to come out in a certain time as you would be with a political book. So that was in the other books with the biography of Murray Gell-Mann. It was I'd met him when I was living in Santa Fe and I'd wanted to write a biography, and another one. Well, I guess actually the book I did on quantum computing started out with somebody. It was actually Kevin Kelly, who's an editor at Wired magazine, had read an article that I had in the Times on something to do with decoherence, and And he had sent me an email saying that, wow, that's really great. I think maybe I finally sort of get this. And then he said, you know, what the world really needs is a very short, clear book on quantum computing. So I thought, well, maybe so. So the more I thought about it, it sounded good. And I just finished writing this mammoth biography of Gell-Mann. It was just like, you know, 5 years of my life. So I liked the idea of doing short books. And I sent an email to my editor, and he liked the idea, and then we worked something out. So it goes both ways. You know, sometimes just something I want to find out about. And like with my most recently published book, Miss Leavitt's Stars, is about Henrietta Swan Leavitt, who discovered the Cepheid variable relationship used to measure distances. And my original thought there was that I wanted to write a book about how we measure the universe and just how, you know, just fascinatingly indirect and, you know, it is. And you run across Leavitt's name all the time in like textbooks, and there's usually a little box with Henrietta Swan Leavitt, and you learn nothing about her. She worked at Harvard University Observatory around 1908, and she was hired as a computer to, compute. And that was her title. And then she went on to have this job where they would give her these huge glass plates that had come from this observatory in Arecibo, Peru, and that were shipped by boat, you know, like around the Cape to Boston Harbor. Like a whole bunch of data was lost in one case because one of the ships sank. And then, you know, they'd haul these things down from the mountain, put them on the boat, take them to Harvard Observatory, and then people like Henrietta Leavitt would sit at these tables with this wooden frame with a mirror, you know, to illuminate it from outside, and then they would look at these glass plates. And in her case, she was charged with looking for variable stars. So she would take one plate that had been taken at a certain time at a certain part of the southern sky, and then she'd take a plate that had been taken at the exact same location a month later or 3 months later. One plate was a negative of the other, and you could hold them together. And, you know, if you saw like a large white spot with a dark spot in the middle, or a large dark spot with a white spot in the middle, you would know that the star had changed in intensity. And then you'd go and get the third plate and see if it had gone back down. So she did this incredibly meticulous work for years and years, and then eventually noticed this relationship on these certain stars called Cepheid variables, that the period of the pulsation is logarithmically related to the brightness of the light, and then you could use it as a standard candle. So I was going to start the book that way, because I like the idea of starting with the scene of Henrietta Leavitt, you know, sitting in the Harvard Observatory, bent over her plates, and there's a few pictures of her, and she has, you know, this wonderful Victorian high-buttoned collar and her hair back in a bun, and had just gotten out of Radcliffe, and then I just got really fascinated by her story, and nothing had been written about it, and I just kept finding nothing, and in all these little, you know, canned biographies like in Who's Who and American Scientists that all seem to either be plagiarized from each other or contain contradictions. And so I did some research, and eventually with the help of a really good researcher, a friend of a friend that I knew that lived in the Boston area, we found his letters in the Harvard archives that were between Henrietta Leavitt and Edward Pickering, the director of the observatory, and some between Henrietta Leavitt and Harlow Shapley, who was the later director. And slowly I was able to find little things like that and piece together enough of her story to kind of use it, not as a biography, but just to make the book use the trajectory of Henrietta Swan Leavitt's, what turned out to be rather short and tragic life, to tell the story of how we learned to measure the universe. And it was really her Cepheid variables that Hubble went on to use to show that the Andromeda is actually far enough away that it has to be a galaxy, and it's not just a small nebula that much closer in. So it makes a really, really good saga. You know, and there was just something I wanted to write about, and it's a matter of finding out a interesting way to do it, and then convincing, you know, a publisher that, you know, they should do the book. Yeah, anything else? Okay, well, thank you for coming.